The last few weeks we have looked at Revelation 12 and Revelation 13, certainly two of the most often used chapters in the entire book of Revelation, used to as a basis, many people believe, for some future men who will arise to persecute the church. But as we saw in the past few weeks, Revelation 12 and 13 talks about a great spiritual battle between God and Satan, between good and evil. Revelation 12, of course, we talked about how Satan was pictured as a great fiery red dragon who did everything in his power to stop the coming of the Messiah. And we looked at all several of the occasions throughout time when he tried to stop Jesus from being born. And then, of course, after he was born, he tried to have Jesus killed, of course, through King Herod. And so we looked at that great battle pictured in Revelation 12. Revelation 13 carries the idea of that great battle, of course, into the first century for whom this was written. Revelation 13, we are introduced to two beasts. Two different beasts. The first beast we saw last week, in the very beginning of Revelation 13, the first 10 verses or so. This beast, of course, had a lot of heads, and there was horns on these heads, and he was a ferocious beast, the beast that rose out of the sea, and we talked about the significance of that. The sea typically meaning, especially in the first century, it was symbolic of all the nations of the world, and especially the turmoil that went with those nations. And then we went on to see that this beast in particular referred to that civil Roman government of the first century and personified in the worst emperor of all, and of course that being Domitian, who reigned near the end of the first century. This is the emperor, this is the world leader at the time that was causing the Christians so much pain and sorrow and grief and suffering. And they were living in a time where they didn't know who was going to win. I mean, it was so bad for them. Many were being killed. They were executed, thrown in prison, and all of these things. And so they're wondering, when's it going to end? Is it going to end? Is Domitian and the Roman government going to win? And so those people, and him in particular, are depicted as this ferocious beast with the seven heads and ten horns, and the fact that he had so much power and authority. He had, of course, all the Roman armies behind him. And so he represented the civil government. Tonight we're introduced to another beast at the end of that chapter, the second beast, similar to the first, but different than the first also. So Revelation 13, let's begin in verse 11 when the new beast is introduced. Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. There's the introduction right there. Remember, the first beast rose out of the sea. This one rises out of the earth. And he has, what's interesting, he has the appearance like a lamb. Most of us have seen a lamb, and what do they have? Two cute little horns up here, don't they? You know, on both sides, you see those little horns. So he has the appearance of something that's what? Kind of innocent. Maybe even good. But then what does John say about the lamb? Speaks like a dragon. Who was the great fiery red dragon? Satan. So he's speaking for Satan. He appears to be something good. He appears to be something innocent. He appears to be something worthwhile. Not dangerous in any sense, but what is he in reality? He is a messenger, a worker of Satan. And who better that we've talked about the past several weeks that represents this seemingly safe, good, lamb than those people in the first century that worked for the Roman government, but we called them the concilia last week and the week before. These were the ones that were given power by the imperial civil Roman government to enforce emperor worship. They had the power to go around. They had the power to execute. They had the power to throw in prison. They had the power to persecute. They had the power, as we'll see in a little bit, to put economic sanctions on the people, to persecute them financially, which, of course, was very important, just like it would be for us today. So here we have two different beasts, but they both have the same aim. One is very upfront. You know, the imperial Roman Empire, Roman government, civil government, there was nothing deceitful about them. They were very upfront. They were after the Christians. But they also used this group of priests. They were kind of like a cult. And they were the ones that were going around. They had images built. And they would go around and try and force Christians to bow down to the image. They didn't have to bow down and say much. But they tried to get them to do that. And if they wouldn't, then they had all the power given to them by the Roman government to persecute, kill those Christians. And so, it was somewhat a religion. You know, they were called priests, and so in many ways it was a religion because they were promoting emperor worship. And the worst time of emperor worship, the most severe time of emperor worship, was during the time of Domitian. Again, toward the end of the first century. He was the worst. He was the one, more than any of the other emperors, who demanded that he be addressed as divinity, as a divine being, as God, as the Lord, as the sovereign ruler. That's what he wanted. The other emperors before him, not so much. But he, more than any of the others, demanded that he be worshipped. When he would walk into the Roman Senate, that's what they were supposed to do. All the senators were supposed to basically, you know, hail your God. And so, as far as he was concerned, he was God. And that's why he had these priests going around trying to enforce people to do that. Lambs, of course, throughout time have always been representative of religious sacrifice and in particular of religion. And so in this case, it was a false religion, but it was still a religion because they promoted emperor worship, which was a type of religion with a lot of power. Notice 12. Exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. See what the second beast was to do? Cause people, all the nations of the world, to bow down to the first beast. And that's, of course, what these priests, this concilia, that's what they did. They went around forcing people to bow down to the first beast, the Roman government, especially as it was personified in Domitian. The worst of all, as far as thinking he was divine. He was God. And so that's what they did. That was their job, you might say. And it was in his presence. They were given all the authority. And it says, the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. We talked about that last week. Remember when Nero, who was, of course, some 15, 20 years before, he was the emperor some 15 or 20 years before Domitian. He persecuted Christians a lot before the destruction of Jerusalem. He died. And so we talked last week how people rejoiced, especially Christians. But many people, when Domitian came into power, actually there were rumors all over the Roman Empire that Domitian was simply Nero resurrected. And in a way he was, because the same type of characteristics that Nero had were in Domitian. He was cruel and hateful and wicked and evil. Domitian just took those characteristics and multiplied them, intensified them, and made him far worse. So that first one was healed in the sense that people thought Domitian was simply Nero resurrected. And like I said, in many ways, he was. And so the second beast gets his power from the first. He goes around trying to get Christians, everyone, to bow down to the Roman emperor. And if they didn't, they were punished. So what does this beast do? Verse 13. And he performs great signs, so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. He's a deceiver. Remember, I said he was, you know, he looks like a lamb. Looks very innocent, but in reality, he's backed by the dragon, Satan. So he's a deceiver. How does he deceive people? It says here he performs great wonders and signs. He couldn't perform, you know, those priests and so forth, they couldn't perform miracles. They didn't have miraculous power, but they could fool people into believing they did. And if you go back in history and read toward the end of the first century, when they built these images, as he talks about in verse 14, they built images of Domitian, the Roman emperors. They built these altars, shrines, whatever you would say. And they would actually trick people into believing those were alive. Historians say they were accomplished ventriloquists. You know, we think ventriloquism is something modern in our age, but it's been practiced for thousands of years. They practiced it, the priests did. And so they were able to make people believe that those shrines and idols and images could actually talk. And they were able to make the images have smoke come out of them and so forth, and that's not all that hard to do. We didn't invent chemistry today. That's been around a long time. So they knew those things back in the first century to make common people believe that those idols were really alive. And so they performed these great signs or these lying wonders. Why? To deceive people. And of course, they were good at it. He was granted the power to do that. He was able to do that because people would believe it. And of course, as far as that goes, things haven't changed. People will still believe. As we've seen on Wednesday night in our Bible study, people religiously will believe the most bizarre things sometimes before they'll believe things that actually make sense. They'll believe the most bizarre things, most bizarre ideas religiously. They did in the first century. They do today. People could actually watch those idols being made, and then after they were made, thought they somehow became alive. How foolish. But yet, people today still do pretty much the same thing. They really do. So let's see what happens. What did he say was going to happen? He was granted power, the beast was, to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many would not worship as would not worship the image of the beast, to be killed. He causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on the right hand or on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Now, there's a great deal that needs to be talked about in those things, and we could probably talk about them for a long time, but there's certainly some things that are important. Number one, as I mentioned, they were deceitful. You know, false teachers, regardless of what kind of religion it is, from the very beginning, they operate on deceit. They have to operate on deceit, because if they operated truthfully, nobody would follow them. So inherent in any false religion is the idea of operating by deceit. It has to operate by deceit. It has to make up things that people will want to be a part of, will want, they'll desire that. And again, sometimes the more bizarre, the more unbelievable, the more people will follow it. Well, that's people's nature today, but that was people's nature in the first century too. People's nature hasn't changed at all. And so that's why they would do this. That's why they would use deceit, because they knew it worked. And they knew that the majority of the people would fall for it. So that's why they did it. And again, same thing happens today. People that saw through it, Christians that knew it was false, knew these idols weren't talking or weren't alive, they refused to bow down in any way. And sometimes the only thing these priests would ask Christians to do is just, they wouldn't even ask him to bow down. You could just say, well, say, Caesar is Lord. That's it. That's all you'd have to say. We'll leave you alone. We'll go on. Wouldn't do it. And a lot of people might have thought, well, that's not asking much. But by saying that, you are worshiping another God. You're saying someone besides Jehovah is God. And so that's why the Christians wouldn't do it, the vast majority of them. And so many of them died as a result of that, because they wouldn't bow down. And if you've ever had a chance to read some of the people who didn't bow down to the authorities of the day, I encourage you to do that. Read about the martyrs. Very encouraging. So that's what they would do. And so he caused all, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their forehead. Now this isn't the first time we've been told about a mark, right? We were told prior to this that those who were faithful to God received a mark. Remember, this was several chapters back. They received a mark that they were following God. They were children of God. It wasn't a literal mark. It wasn't a physical mark. It wasn't anything stamped on their forehead. It wasn't in any way a real mark. But it was a distinction in how they lived and how they behaved. And I think ultimately that's what he's telling us here too. The people that followed the beast did what? They bowed down to the idols, the images. They offered up their worship to him. Those were the people that did that. And because these people would bow down, they were granted privileges. They were granted privileges. But the Christians who wouldn't do it, the Christians who wouldn't bow down, and again, this is found in a lot of historical books from that time. Those people who wouldn't bow down were persecuted in a lot of ways. One way was financially, economically. They were, a lot of their privileges to buy and sell were taken away from them. They couldn't participate in certain trades or guilds or crafts. And so those type of things were taken away. Well, can you imagine if you've been making your living all your life a certain way, and then one day that's taken away from you? You can't do that anymore. And so your whole livelihood is gone just like that. See, these priests that would go around trying to force people to bow down had the power to do that to anyone who wouldn't bow down. And so they could cause Christians' lives to be very miserable in that sense, financially. And so that's what they did. So it said that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Or the number of his name. And he says, here is wisdom. And of course, the people in the first century wouldn't have had any problem with this whatsoever. We don't talk like this today. You know, we don't use a lot of symbolism today like they did. And we don't use this type of literature like they did. But to people in the first century, especially Christians, of course, to whom this was written, they wouldn't have had any trouble at all understanding this. Here is wisdom. Here's what you need to know. Here is what's going to help. Let him who has understanding, so wisdom and understanding are certainly kind of put with each other, calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. And we need to really focus on the fact that it says it's the number of a man, not the number of the man. There is no definite article in the original language. Most people in the denominational world take that as saying it's the number of the man, a particular man. But the original language says, no, it's not. And it's very clear. Matter of fact, that could easily be translated in the Greek language as it is the number, or it is man's number. Well, what has he been making contrasts and comparisons from in the last two chapters? There's always been comparisons, right? There's God on one side and Satan on the other. Well, who's he putting man's with in this case? Well, he's putting him with Satan. That's what he's doing. It says this is man's number. Have you ever heard a couple of people talking and after a while they'll say, well, I've got your number. That's how it's used here. I've got your number. What do they mean when they say that? I know exactly what you're really like. I know who you are. I know your nature. I know what you're really doing. That's what he's saying here. Not a real number. Not like there's something magical about 666. There isn't. There's nothing magical about it at all. But what do you? That's what he means when you say, "Well, I've got your number." You may be fooling other people, but you're not fooling me. I know what you're really like. And through inspiration, that's what God's telling the Christians here. That's what these people are really like. And that God is still going to be victorious. He does use, again, you know, the symbol of numbers, again, was so common in the first century. And we just don't do that today very much, other than lucky number 7. That's the only one we really use much of. But in the first century, numbers had so many meanings to those people. Very different than our culture. We've looked at the number 7 throughout, you know, this whole book and what it meant. We talked about how it meant the idea of completeness and wholeness and fulfillment, all of those things. Well, to people in the first century, 6 meant, it's not going to be fulfilled. It's not going to be completed. 7 usually had something to do with God being behind it. So when you use the number 6, you're saying God's not behind it. It's not God's doing. It's not God's dealing. It's whose? It's man's. So when he says this is the number, as he says, it's the number of a man, it's like John is saying, I've got your number, and I know what your nature is, and it's not like God. It is as opposed to God as you can imagine. Now, the people in the first century, if John would have said his number is 6, that meant something different than saying his number is 666. Remember back in Isaiah chapter 6 when the seraphim are flying around the throne? And what do they do a lot in that chapter? They repeat something 3 times. Holy, holy, holy. Why do they do that? For emphasis. So why is 6 used 3 times here? For emphasis. He's emphasizing that this is man's doing. This is not God's in any way. This is the nature of man. This is sinful. This is wicked. This is evil. This is not going to be completed because God's not behind it. Man's behind it, and ultimately Satan's behind it, and Satan's not going to win. So you would have understood that if you were a Christian in the first century, knowing that, number one, this has nothing to do with God. God's not behind any of these things, but that Satan is, and it's evil, and it's not going to come to completeness. The Christians in the first century, if he said his number is 777, they would have been terrified. But by saying it's 666, they weren't. And today, people that have interpreted this book has done what? 666 is being just the most terrifying number at all. And it shouldn't be. Because it says, it's not going to come to completeness. Because God's not behind it. It's not God's will. It's man's will. And it's man's nature. It's that evil, wicked nature. It's not talking about a person. And every denominational person I've ever heard or read or seen on TV believes it's talking about an individual, the Antichrist. Whereas the Bible gives no credence to that whatsoever. It's talking about man's nature, knowing man's number. I've got your number. God says, I've got your number. I know what that nature is. Because what it represents is human, not divine. So it's a human number. And if you want to read pages and pages and pages of what different people have thought that 666 meant, I mean, it would literally fill books from one of the early Caesars, from the word Latinos, to Nero, to Domitian, to the Pope, to Hitler. And you can put together any sort of number scheme. And as I mentioned, it has nothing to do really with any sort of code or number. But people try to do that because that's what people want to hear. Kind of like the Da Vinci Code. And that intrigues people. So they'll listen to it. They won't listen to the truth because that's not as intriguing. But with any number code you can make, I looked at one this week, you can make 666 refer to Jesus Christ very easily. Very easily. I don't think too many people would want to say that represented Jesus Christ, but it's just as easy to make those numbers some sort of code for Him as it is for anybody else. So it shows that it's meaningless and futile and just downright silly to do that. Because He's not using those numbers in that way at all. They did take it as a bad omen, a symbol of dread in a sense, but not a symbol of good because God wasn't behind it. It wasn't referring to God. It was referring to man's nature. So it's a number, not a name. And it talks about man's nature, his character. His character. And that ends that chapter. And what a war has been going on in chapter 12 and 13. God and the dragon. And the dragon is fighting the woman and fights the child. The first beast rises up to fight against Christians, that civil Roman government. Second beast rises up, that priestly cult that gets its power from the Roman government to persecute Christians. And it may look like things are pretty hopeless. And that there is dread and doom and all these kinds of things out there. But God's going to win, as was mentioned in the prayer. That's what Revelation says. God wins. Many people, when they pick up a book of fiction, they'll do what? Either go to the last paragraph, see who wins, or see what happens. You don't really have to do that in the book of Revelation because almost every chapter tells you that. God wins. God wins. May look bleak, and then again, 666 looked bleak for many people. First and second beasts looked bleak. But when it's looked at rightly and interpreted rightly, it's still the same message. God is the winner. God's victorious. And so even though it's going to be a tough time and even though there's going to be suffering, it's not going to be forever. Again, that number six, not forever. It's not complete. It's not going to go on forever. It's temporary. And that gave them some hope. Even though, yeah, they were dreading what was going to happen and what was happening, and rightfully so, but still, it was eventually going to stop. God was going to bring down the Roman Empire. God was going to bring down those priests, and they would never be in the world again. And that's how Revelation 14 or 13 ends. And what a message for us. Even in the darkest, bleakest of times, we know God wins. How do we know? Because we went to the end of the book and looked. And that's how we know. So if we're going to be victorious, we have to be on God's side, in His family. Have to experience that new birth and remain faithful. Because we know how the story ends. And that's maybe the best part of being a Christian. We don't have to wonder how the story ends. We've already been told. Regardless what the world thinks or what is happening in the world, we know the end. If you need to come tonight, I encourage you as we stand and sing this invitation song.